You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12-powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. We have such a great show this week. First and foremost, we're going to be talking to one of my favorite sports authors, Paul Knepper, who has a book out called Moses Malone, The Life of a Basketball Prophet. If you are at all interested in the legendary three-time most valuable player, you have to check this out. Moses Malone, The Life of a Basketball Prophet. Also, speaking of hoops, I'm going to be talking to the savant, Arya Shirazi, about the various moving targets in the National Basketball Association this year, and which one of our preseason predictions are we most proud of, and which do we wish we could have a do-over on. But first and foremost, before we get to Arya, let's talk to Paul Knepper about Moses Malone, The Life of a Basketball Prophet. The book is Moses Malone, The Life of a Basketball Prophet. The author is Paul Knepper. We're thrilled to have him on the show. Paul, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
All right, we got to start for our young listeners here. Let's talk about Moses Malone. My personal view is that of the top 20 players to ever play in the NBA, he is the most underrated. And proof of that is that in some of these top 20 lists, you don't even see Moses Malone. So please, for our listeners, make the case for Moses Malone as a top-tier, inner circle, all-time great.
Okay. First, I think Moses' impact really starts with him being the first modern-day player to go straight from high school to pros, which was a huge deal at the time. So he is a trailblazer. And as far as his legendary career, Moses is one of only nine players to win three or more NBA MVP awards. It's a very prestigious list. Shaq didn't do that. Kobe didn't do that. Tim Duncan, Oscar Robertson, on and on. Tons of greats didn't do that. He was the best player on one of the greatest teams of all time, the 1982-83 76ers. And he is, but statistically, he is the greatest offensive rebounder of all time by such a wide margin that it's hard to fathom just how far he is ahead of the field. So with all those things, I think I agree with you. He's not talked about nearly enough. That was part of the impetus behind this book, to kind of bring him back into the light, particularly for younger generations who didn't see him and know how great he was.
Absolutely. Now, a great player, no doubt. You talked about him being the first ever to come right out of high school. Out of Petersburg, Virginia, which is sort of near where we are doing this interview right now. So I got to give a shout out to my part of the world here. In your research, though, how is it received at the time, this idea of being right out of high school, going right into the pros, foregoing an opportunity to go to the University of Maryland, and I'm sure many other places that would have bowed and scraped to have him matriculate there? How is that received in the media and in the public is part one of this question. Part two is, was there any infrastructure in pro basketball at the time to make sure that a teenager like him coming right out of high school wouldn't fall through the cracks?
Those are great questions. As the first one, he faced tremendous backlash, as every trailblazer does, right? There was a lot of anger. Moses, by skipping college, he presented a massive threat to the major economic system known as NCAA. And so lots of schools and coaches and executives were furious because they were like, uh-oh, well, if all the top talent starts skipping college, that's going to affect our bottom line, right? And that's going to affect our salaries. And so people were angry. The NBA wasn't particularly happy because the NCAA had served as a free farm system for the league since the league's inception, and they were worried they would be losing that. And so there was tremendous backlash from both of those levels. And then you have to remember the place and the time. Moses grew up, Petersburg was a segregated city until the mid-60s. And that's where Moses grew up. And this is not that long after that. And you have, it's not just anybody challenging this massive economic system. It's a young, uneducated black man who is posing a threat to the system. And there was an undertone of racism to a lot of the criticism that he received. The pushback, there were writers who said, hey, well, baseball players have been doing this forever, and tennis players have been doing this forever. But there seemed to be a more paternal view towards predominantly African American sports. And I think that was a lot behind the backlash. As for infrastructure in place, no, there was none. And I think that's a lot of what made it so difficult. I actually talk in early in the book, compare Moses's jump from high school to pros to what, Kevin Garnett and Tracy McGrady and LeBron and Kobe did decades later. How, when Moses came in, you had one head coach, you had one assistant coach. There was no team, strength and conditioning coach. There were no team psychologists and all these developmental coaches and all of that. Which are commonplace now, and even, were to some extent when the guys I mentioned before came to the league. There was nobody there to hold Moses' hand. There's nobody to teach him, to make sure to look out for his mental well-being, when he made that huge leap. And so he was fortunate in that he played with the Utah Stars in the ABA. He had some great veterans who did kind of look out for him. But within the structure of the team, the management and coaching and that kind of thing, there was nothing provided to him.
Well, even today, you hear players talk about the cultural adjustment, black players, to be very specific, the cultural adjustment about going to a place like Utah to play. How was that for a 1970s teenage kid to go from the East Coast to Utah and just then be told, all right, you're now going to be a star basketball player?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, I talked to some of the black players' teammates he had. I have a great quote in the book from Willie Wise, ABA All-Star, who talked about how difficult it was to be a black man in Salt Lake City, which was 99.9% white at the time. And he just said it was the people were kind. A lot of business leaders invited the players to their homes for dinner and stuff like that. The community was kind. The guys had no ill will towards the community, but there was no culture there for them. The restaurants, the scenes, the type of places they like to hang out, people who understood and could empathize with their background and their upbringing. And so Moses struggled with that. He was lonely, particularly his rookie year. He was very lonely, because he didn't have family. He was so young, he talked about somehow some of the, a lot of the guys on the team were older and had families, children and a wife, and here he was 19 years old, and he was lost, and he spent a lot of time in his hotel room watching TV, and he lived in a hotel in Salt Lake City near the arena, and he spent a lot of time in his hotel room watching TV and listening to music. That was kind of how he passed his time.
I mean, did Moses, to your knowledge, ever muse about the fact that maybe it wasn't the worst thing in the world to be a teenager with disposable income, very little controlling authority, and yet you're in Utah, not say New York City?
Yeah, no, it might have been. I never heard anything of him reflecting on that specifically, but it very well might have been that, obviously there were a lot less trappings in Utah than in other places.
It just reminded me of Kevin Durant saying that while he preferred Seattle to Oklahoma City, Oklahoma City definitely helped his game after the team moved because there was so little else to do.
Yeah.
Although, he did shout out Seattle always, so props there. I have some questions about this title, The Life of a Basketball Prophet, because prophet, two reasons. One, prophet, the implication is the statement of something that proves to be correct in the future, but it could also apply to play. And one thing about Moses's play, I mean, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but you look at today's NBA of pace and space and 7-footers shooting 3-pointers, and it's hard not to see his style, and maybe this lends to why to his underappreciation as somewhat anachronistic relative to how the game is played today. Your thoughts on that statement?
First, as to the profit part, there were a few things went into that. I mean, obviously, some of it was just a play on the biblical Moses. But also Moses, when he was 14 years old, he had just been playing ball for a few months at that point. He just recently taken up the game, and he wrote on a piece of paper that he was going to be the best high school player in the country by the end of his junior season in high school. And he tucked that into the family Bible and stored it there in the family Bible, and it came to fruition. And when it did, at the end of his junior year in high school, he wrote a second note, which said, "I'm going to be the first player to go straight from high school to pros." And that also seemed unfathomable at the time. There didn't
Sure.
seem to be any avenue to do that. And so that, and then of course there was his famous faux 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 prediction, which didn't exactly come true. They ended up doing it faux five faux. They lost one
Well,
game in the playoffs.
Paul, I know faux faux faux, and you know faux faux faux, but you know, for my son's friends who listen to the podcast alone,
Fair enough.
explain faux 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 to the audience, please.
Happy to. So faux 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 was before the playoffs in 1983. The 76ers had one of the greatest regular seasons ever. And Moses was hurting. He had tendonitis in his knee, a fluid buildup, missed the last several games of the regular season. And before the playoffs, Billy Cunningham, his coach, went into the training room to see how he was doing. He said, "Moses, how you doing? How do you feel about the playoffs?" And Moses said, "Faux, faux, faux." Meaning at that time the playoffs were 3 rounds, meaning we're gonna win four games, and four games, and four games, and we're not gonna lose a game in the whole playoffs, which had never been done before. And Billy told me, he said, from your mouth to God's ears." And there's more to that story, and some people say it didn't play out exactly like that. That's Billy's version. That's the legend that certainly developed. And they came close. They only lost one game in the second round. So and after they lost that one game, Moses said, "Okay, faux five faux." And actually, faux five faux is inscribed on their championship rings.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's amazing.
So and back to your second point. Yeah, I think it's part of the reason that Moses is underappreciated is that I think younger generations would have a difficult time relating to his style of play and his game, and it has very much the game isn't played that way anymore. And so I do think that's hurt his legacy a bit.
And which is also a shame because it's so interesting because there are still players like Moses, but they're seen as like the blue collar people who do all the hard work, which Moses was, except in Moses's day, that could make you an MVP if you were the best blue collar guy on the court, you know, 30 points, 12 rebounds of blue collar work. Now, if you're that guy, you're 8 points, 11 boards, kicking the ball out to 3-point shooters, caring more about quote unquote rim protection than actual block shots. It's just a very different way of conceiving yourself if you are that kind of blue collar person, a very different way that the coach will slot you if you're that kind of blue collar person.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people refer to Moses as the lunch pail superstar. And again, going back to your original point, keep coming back to this, I think there are a number of reasons why he is not talked about as much as he should be. And one of them is, I think there was no flash to Moses. None. You know, he didn't soar the basket like Dr. J. He wasn't a wizard with the ball like Magic Johnson. He wasn't shooting 30-foot daggers like Steph Curry. He didn't flex his muscles when he made a shot or do some elaborate hand gesture, all that. Moses just went about his business, right? He just worked hard. And I think that didn't necessarily make for sports center highlights. And I don't think younger fans are pulling up YouTube clips of Moses fighting for offensive rebounds the way they might of Michael dunking or Magic passing.
Right. Wow. Great point on that. Like what becomes pleasurable for a YouTube audience or a highlight audience can be very different than what thrilled 76ers fans to see him dominate somebody like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the NBA Finals. Just apples and oranges.
One of his teammates, Mike Newland, I don't know if you remember that name, he played for the Rockets. Mike Newland told me his analogy was, he said, Moses was a waterfall, just constant, steady flow of pressure. But he said nothing particularly stood out. There was nothing, you wouldn't look at Moses any play and be like, wow, that was exceptional, because it was almost all exceptional. And it was unrelenting and constant. And there were never any breaks in the action. There was never any break in his effort for you to contrast with the spectacular play. It was just one steady waterfall. And to your point, I think that the waterfalls don't make for great highlights.
One of the things about Moses is that I know you touch upon in the book is about like the mocking of his intelligence, due to poverty, due to race, due to lack of media training, which frankly just did not exist until recent years. This idea that that teams would be responsible to making sure that players would be snappy in front of the microphone. What do you say to that history of the denigration of the intelligence of Moses Malone?
Yeah, it's sad, it's upsetting, and some of it was, some of it rooted racism, and some of it, I think, and his lack of education, and some of it was, I don't know that I want to blame him for this, but some of it was due to a vacuum that he created. In other words, he was very gruff with the media. He didn't play the media game, and he didn't answer questions, and so that led some to suspect maybe he's not intelligent. And that's part of what led me want to write the book too, is like, who's the man behind that gruff demeanor? Who is the real Moses? And I talked to so many of teammates, and many use the word brilliant, that he was brilliant. And if you start just from a basketball standpoint, you can't win three MVPs without having a very high basketball IQ. I mean, that's just part of it. But they would talk about off the floor as well. He had a great mathematical mind, and he was very intelligent. And I guess I would caution people, you have to don't jump to conclusions. Don't presume things. You have to get to know someone and hear what they have to say. But actually, even the fo-fo-fo thing bothered him, because he kind of bought into the legend, but he viewed it as kind of like, what they used to do with Latino baseball players, like Clemente, how they would quote him in phonetics, and Moses, it actually Moses told friends it bothered him that it was written as fo 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 instead of 4-4-4.
I get
And
it. Yeah.
I found that really interesting. Never really thought about that before, but it makes sense when you think of it in the context of Latino players. And so, I think it was even worse then, because I think to some extent, like African American vernacular and Southern vernacular has become a little more mainstream. I think rap music has helped with that very much. And so there's a little more understanding of that than there.
Well, Paul, you froze. Are you there?
The most important thing
There you go.
is keep an open mind and don't jump to conclusions about people.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a lesson for people to take from this. Another part of that legacy for people who mock his intelligence is honestly how much he meant to two of the smartest player, acknowledged, I should say, smartest players, one being Charles Barkley. And the other being the on-court genius that is Hakeem Olajuwon. Can you speak a little bit about Moses as legacy, as somebody who impacted the legacies of other players, and how that's a part of Moses's legacy?
Absolutely. I think he really embraced the role of mentor. And we hear about those guys because they're all-time great players, but he mentored countless players. And he treated the third round draft pick who's just trying to make the team the same way he treated Dr. J. And he'd take you under his wing and he'd teach you things. But Barkley and Hakeem are the most notable. And Barkley has said many times, Moses is the one individual most responsible for his success in the NBA. Because Bar Moses taught him how to work hard, and there's a great story in the book where Mo Moses Barkley's not playing much in his rookie year, and he's frustrated, and he doesn't know why. And so he and Moses lived in the same building, apartment building. So he goes to talk to Moses, and he lays it out of what Bill, Coach Billy's not playing me, and why am I playing? Blah blah. And Moses looks him up and down, and he says, "You're fat and lazy." And but he didn't leave it at that. He took Charles under his wing, and he said, "Lose 10 pounds." And Charles did. He said, "Lose 10 more pounds." And he worked with him before practice and after practice. And he ran with him on the track near their apartment building. And Charles Barkley started calling Moses dad. And I don't think it was all in jest. Until the day Moses died, he called him dad. So he had an impact, but that was just, again, we hear that story because Charles Barkley is Charles Barkley, and Charles Barkley loves to talk. But there were dozens and dozens of players who he mentored throughout his career.
I will say, in all the years Barkley has been on television, his grief after Moses passed was something that, to me, really does stand out. In just in terms of Barkley's own broadcast history, and
He
not
de he
something,
del he yeah he I believe that he delivered a beautiful eulogy at Moses' funeral, actually.
Wow. So, I wanted to add, you've clearly learned so much just by writing this book. What's one thing in particular, though, that you learned about Moses that you did not know or did not suspect when starting the writing process?
I mean, the biggest things I didn't know are, I knew a great deal about the player. I didn't know a lot about the person. And I touched on that before. And I would, a few things in particular. One is we touched on his intelligence. A second is he had a great sense of humor. He was a real prankster in the locker room. One of his funny things I really liked was he would call a teammate, like he'd call Maurice Cheeks and say, "Hey, Mo, hey, pretend to be Andrew Toney." He'd call Maurice Cheeks, pretend to be Andrew Toney, and say, "Mo, meet me at whatever such and such restaurant at 9 o'clock tonight." And Mo would go meet him, and of course Andrew Toney wasn't there because it was Moses pretending to be Andrew Toney. The last thing I would say is his humility was staggering for a player of his accomplishments. As one of his oldest friends said it to me, when Moses started winning MVPs and he won a championship, everyone around him changed the way they looked at him, but he never changed the way he viewed himself. And I think his teammates revered him precisely because he didn't ask to be. He never asked for any special perks. There are quotes of Moses where he talks about how he doesn't understand the concept of a superstar. And he actually seems bewildered by it. He says, "Basketball is a team game. How do you single out one person? I'm just one of the guys." But it wasn't just words, because he treated the 12th man at the end of the bench the same way he treated Dr. J, and he treated the janitor in the arena the same way he treated Dr. J. So there was a and he had he had no regard, no interest in fame whatsoever. Zero. He thought it was nonsense. And we've seen other guys like that. I think Jokic is like that now. Tim
I
Duncan
keep
was like
thinking of
that.
Jokic. I know that both burly guys, maybe that's why it sinks in my head, but I keep thinking of Jokic as you talk about Moses, actually.
Yeah, that's it. I've thought of that as well. And so his humility I found very endearing. So those are some of the personality traits that I really enjoyed learning about.
No, that's incredible. One more question for you. Thank you so much for your time. I'm always honest with my audience. I am so excited to pick this book up, to buy it, to read it, because I love this history. I love this era. Loved your previous book about the 90s Knicks. So I'm very excited to jump into this one, being honest with the listeners that I've yet to crack it, but I'm very excited to do so. But I did want to ask you what I always ask authors, which is about music and the role that music may have played in your own life during the writing process, whether as something to work, to listen to while you worked, something that perhaps inspired you and made you think of Moses' story, or something you listened to wind down. Where is music in the writing process for you?
I'm interested. I love music, but I can't write while listening to music. One thing I would guess one thing it sparked in me was Moses loved music, and he loved He loved the old rhythm and blues stuff, some of the soul music, Motown type stuff. Loved the Temptations, for example. He loved Earth, Wind, and Fire. And so some of those bands that in talking to people and, oh yeah, I went to, I used to go to this, I went to this concert with Moses, I went to that concert with Moses. That genre of music, I found myself, sometimes it's just in your head. And of course, that's wonderful music. You don't need an excuse to listen to the Temptations, but I found myself listening to that kind of music more. The Manhattans, there's a couple of groups I wasn't even very familiar with. So I give them credit for that, for introducing me to a couple of groups. So that would have been the influence. That would have been the role of music, is that he Moses kind of pushed me in a certain direction for a little while.
That's awesome. Paul Knepper, I can't wait to read the book, Moses Malone, the prophet himself. I can't wait to check this out, man. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave. I'm a huge fan of yours, your writing, and the podcast, so it's a pleasure.
Oh, terrific. Thank you. We'll be right back after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. As promised, to look at the first, let's call it eighth of the NBA season, a time of moving targets, a time of shifting predictions. We are so happy to have with us to assess where we're at, as promised, the guy I call the basketball savant, Arya Shirazi. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I mean, it's so much has happened in the league. I feel like we've been through 10 soap operas since we made our predictions. And I'm very excited to just sort of assess where we're at in terms of what we said, what we thought would happen, and then where those thoughts are at this point. To me, that's one of the funnest parts about charting the season. So, but I do want to start by what, as we're talking, is some breaking news. Won't be breaking news by the time people hear about this, but it still, to me, signals probably the most high-octane story right now in the NBA that doesn't involve what happens between the lines, and that's the firing in Dallas of general manager Nico Harrison. Now, just to do the quickest possible review, the Dallas Mavericks, which play, people don't realize this, in like, I think it's the third largest TV market in the United States. It's bigger than Chicago. It's crazy. And it's the only team in town, unlike LA and New York, although we don't count the Nets. So this team, they make the finals in 2024. Nico Harrison, the GM, makes the most, you have to say, gobsmacking trade in NBA history, shocking trade, as in reporters getting texts from other reporters saying, "I think you just got hacked," like for even reporting this. And that was sending Luka Doncic to the Lakers, the 25-year-old who had already been on five first-team All-NBA teams at age 25. Now, Nico Harrison does this based on two arguments. One, I'm selling high on Luka because he's going to be injury prone because he's out of shape. And two, maybe he led us to the finals, but he can't lead a team to a title. Okay, those are two arguments that he has. He knows more than we do. But what was so gobsmacking was he trades him straight up for a player, Anthony Davis, who is 8 years older, who is always injured. So if part of your argument is about durability, trading for Anthony Davis is seriously, it's like trading for a bicycle when you're saying I need a better car. And then the argument he can't lead a team to a title, it's like Anthony Davis can. That's interesting. I mean, he was the number two guy on the bubble title team in LA, but even that was at the time 5 years ago, which is a lifetime for a player of Anthony Davis's tender joints. So that was weird then. And nonsensically, it was so nonsensical that it led to all kinds of conspiracy theories about why such a wild trade would even happen. Many of those conspiracy theories propagated by me. Rooted in, this is about moving the team to Las Vegas. This is about, and so you gut the fan base by trading Luka. This is about the Adelson family, which bought the team from Mark Cuban, a team of repugnant billionaire Trump-supporting Zionists. So maybe there's some connection there that has rooted in, I don't know, evil Epstein Island. Who the hell knows? But fast forward to today. So that's what we were saying last January. Fast forward to today, to the last 9 months. What's taken place? Well, out of nowhere, the Dallas Mavericks are able to draft a generational talent named Cooper Flagg, probably the best American drafted or the most highly touted American since Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis, Mr. Durability, has played 9 out of a possible 44 games, which everybody was worried about when they got him in the first place. Luka became body beautiful, cover of Men's Health, and is probably the MVP now for the playing for the Lakers, the hated rival of the Dallas Mavericks. Fans were chanting "Fire Nico" all season as the team got off to a 3-9 start, including chanting it when this 18-year-old kid is at the foul line. And so I think they entered this mode of, okay, forget about moving the team to Las Vegas, because I still think that was part of the thinking. Forget about gutting the fan base. We have an 18-year-old incredible player who is now being trained in an utterly dysfunctional environment. We got to get rid of this general manager. And that's what happened. And so what you end up with is a flat as a trade that was absolutely as bad as we all thought it was going to be. And it's resulted in the firing of somebody who, very chestily said, we're going to win a title in the next 2 years. And instead, he's gone in 9 months. So before we get to some of our predictions and where they're panning out now in the year, Shiraz, I wanted to know if you had any thoughts about any of these dynamics, from the firing to the incredible ascension of Luka as a player this year. And it's hard to believe he could ascend any higher, but he looks better than ever. To how terrible the Mavericks look, to Cooper Flagg. I mean, what are your thoughts on this whole melange of crap?
The start that the Dallas Mavericks have had to this season is kind of a rare instance of cosmic justice, actually, in life and in sports. When we gave our season preview a few weeks ago, I said that to my chagrin, I thought the Mavericks would be above solid this year, would be a playoff team. I thought they had actually one of the most deep and diverse rosters in the entire league before Kyrie Irving comes back in the second half. And so I thought the Mavericks were going to be a good team and a factor all season long. The fact that they have gotten off to this kind of catastrophic start is comforting. And I very, very rarely call for somebody's job. But Nico Harrison, obviously the face of this all and the fall guy. So I am surprised, but not disappointed with what is going on in Dallas. I don't know that we should read too much into how this portends for Cooper Flagg's career. Hopefully, it's going to be a very long career, and this is the first 3 weeks of it. So I wouldn't attach any undue importance to what this is doing to his development, his growth as a player and a person. I think the Mavericks still have the team. to turn it around. I don't have faith that Jason Kidd is the person who can navigate early dysfunction and turn it around. Jason Kidd can sometimes be a one-man dysfunction unto himself. So yeah, really interesting what's going on in Dallas in the early going, whether or not this is just going to be a disaster of a season, which is what that franchise, if not that fan base, deserves. How Luka and the Lakers are playing in LA just makes the whole thing kind of more delicious and, in a way, predictable. But it also, in a way, this might be, as you referenced earlier, might be going exactly according to unseemly plan and in further alienating that fan base. The Adelsons might be ever closer to being able to move this team to Epstein Island.
It's funny. The Adelsons have said quite explicitly that they have a dream of a casino in Dallas where the team is basically an attraction in the casino. Now, the casino was getting very little foothold in the Texas state legislature because they were too busy, I don't know, banning Hope to. To do something about a new casino. So that led to the conspiracy theory of, well, she already has massive casinos in Las Vegas. So and we all know that the NBA thinks that Las Vegas and Seattle are the next two places whether they want teams, either through moving teams or expansion. So that really, to me, that made all this sense because the trade itself made no sense. It didn't make sense. We're worried about injuries. Let's get Anthony Davis. We're trading one of the three best players in the NBA. Hey, here's an idea. Let's tell nobody. So there's no bidding war for one of the three best. It made no tangible sense. So that's why a lot of people like myself were looking for the shadows behind the scenes. But then other people are saying, well, it's actually because the Adelsons had their heads so far up Trump's behind, they weren't even, and they knew nothing about basketball, that Nico pretty much just ran amok and now it's cost him his job. So who knows what the actual truth is. But I do know this, Shiraz. Right now, the big open question speaks to what you just said, which is there is apparently a debate in the organization. Do we just start looking for people who will take Anthony Davis 10 cents on the dollar right now? Do we tell Kyrie to not even come back this year and just get as strong as possible? And maybe we trade him or maybe we bring him in because he's very popular and still an amazing player. And Cooper Flagg clearly needs an upgrade in point guard for him to develop. And he's not the point guard of the future, which they tried to make him at the start of the year, which I watched some of the games. It was not good. So, and you don't want your point guard to have 10 rebounds and zero assists, which happened a couple of times. So it's going to be interesting, Shiraz, because there are other voices who are saying what you're saying, which is, okay, get the Nico cloud out of there so nobody's chanting fire Nico, and let's try to get some proof of concept. Let's get Davis back on the court. Let's get Kyrie to do what he was doing, which was ramping up to get back sooner rather than later. So it'll be interesting to see what they try to do, if they decide to flush this, because they also have a sweet draft pick in what is supposed to be the best draft in eons. So who knows? We will see.
As far as on the court, I would think that it's too early to try to blow everything up. You have too many good players to rebuild, and I think that that's unnecessary. I think that Cooper Flagg would benefit more from stepping into a veteran contending team as opposed to what most rookie phenoms do, which is step into a deep lottery situation and put up a ton of shots on losing teams. So on a on the larger, murkier level, The NBA might have eyes towards Las Vegas and Seattle, but Adam Silver and the NBA business community is definitely not looking to not have a team in the third biggest market in the country. That is
Exactly.
not part of the NBA's business plan.
No, exactly.
As we said,
You just spoke to another conspiracy theory, though, which is how does a team with a 0.3% chance of getting the number one pick in the draft get the number one pick in the draft, who just happens to be this generational 18-year-old talent? So
I'd say that was certainly not legit.
it can't be legit. It's so absurd. Hi, we just made the worst trade in NBA history, and now we have the number one pick. And you know what? In a weird way, I'm like, good for Dallas fans to not be like, oh, screw Luka. We've got Cooper Flagg now. They're like, no, we love Luka. This ain't stopping. Good for them. All right. So let's get to our preseason picks versus our today's picks. You and I both had a lot of bold statements. I was going over yours. I got to tell you, some of what you said, I'm being very straight up, like really impressed me because I listen to a lot of these podcasts and there are certain predictions that everybody was making. And you went counterintuitive on a couple that have panned out in a way that to me is just really impressive. That when you said them, I was like, this can't happen. And in my mind, I was thinking later, like, why did I think what you said? And we're going to get to what you said. Why did I think what you said wouldn't happen? And the main reason was because all these people I saw as experts said it wouldn't happen. So I got to give you props on that. But it ain't like you got everything right either. And we'll talk about that too. And I as well had said some stuff that I'm proud of and stuff that I'm a little bit yikes about. So let's start with you first. We're going to start with the good before we get to le mal and the ugly. So what did you say before the season started that you're feeling really good about right now?
Well, thank you again for those kind words. In the very early going, I am feeling good about the Miami Heat. I mention them as a playoff team. And you and I think most of the experts that you're talking about that I'm not familiar with were pretty dismissive of that. I don't think Miami was in the conversation to do much of anything. And I really liked their acquisition of Norman Powell, and that has paid off. Powell has picked off exactly how he was playing for the Clippers last year, when for the first time in his career, he looks like a guy who can be a number one option on a team winning games. I have liked the Heat. I like the Heat roster makeup. Again, we have both praised Eric Spoelstra. But I don't think that he's working with smoke and mirrors here again. I like the team and the combinations that he can run with, both offensively and defensively. One player that I want to highlight, which I wanted to talk about on this show, and this is the right time, is probably, I mean, right now, one of my two picks for most improved player. I did not have a preseason most improved player that I felt really, really confident behind. And in the East, Jaime Jaquez is looking like not just a Swiss Army knife kind of guy who's kind of good at everything and also really a high IQ guy. He looks fantastic. He looks literally like a guy who should play 35 minutes and bring just about everything to the table in that time, including there have been a couple of games that I've watched where in crunch time, the ball has consistently been in his hands and he puts the ball on the floor and gets to the basket and scores. So, in addition to everything else he does defensively and in the floor game, if this is the kind of player, and in his third season, it makes sense that he would blossom, start really taking a leap into the player that he's going to be. If this is the player he's going to be, then Miami has a really above average starter checking a lot of boxes for a long time. I am encouraged by the start. I had Miami at sixth, I think. Right now, I think they're looking like a top four team to me. And the reason that I think that this is sustainable is because their best scorer and their leading scorer, Tyler Herro, hasn't played a minute yet. And rather than disrupting chemistry when he returns, I think adding Tyler to what they're already kind of creating in the early going, again, propels this team from a team that's looking better than a lot of people thought into a team that I see no reason shouldn't be a factor in this conference the whole season.
Yeah, what they've done, which none of the experts saw them doing, and which again, you got to give it up to Spoelstra here, is they just said, you know what? We're not going to have Tyler for the start of the year. We got Norm Powell coming in, who's great in space. And now they do the fewest pick and rolls by a mile in the NBA. While last year with Hero, they were very much kind of a pick and roll team, pick and pop. There, it's just like we're going to space out. And we're just going to go to town on people. And it's been kind of like a shock to the rest of the NBA. I mean, it's like a pitcher coming in with three new pitches with a knuckler, and it's got everybody on their heels. So I'm actually fascinated. I think Tyler can thrive in such a way. It'll also be a different way for him to play than he did last year when he made his first All-Star team. So, we'll see how much Tyler has the what do they call it? The curse of me. And is willing to play some team ball. So I let's throw it to me then, and I want to throw it back to you because you did a couple of things that you should be feeling pretty good about. I'll just say one of the things that I feel good about that in terms of coming in was I did a finals prediction of the Knicks versus Houston with, if you remember, a big pullback at the end away from Denver and towards Houston. Now, you and I both know that, the Oklahoma City Thunder, they're on their own sphere. The only game they've lost all year, they haven't had Jason Williams all year, and the good Jason Williams, and the one, Jalen Williams, I'm sorry. Jesus, I've got white chocolate on the brain. Or that the guy who shot somebody on the brain. They got bullets of white cocoa on the brain. But no, Jalen Williams gone all year, and who's such a good player. This kid AJ Mitchell is bonkers good, who's taking his spot. Like I heard somebody compare him to Mavericks era Jalen Brunson, where you look at him and you're like, wow, you give this guy his own team, who knows? Like who knows?
A little early for that.
It is. No, I'm just saying like the kind of like there's there more of a kind of a thing. Like there's real talent there. But Houston, the reason why I feel like I really put myself out there with that pick was, of course, not having a point guard, not having Van Vliet. And guess which team has the best offense in the NBA right now? Why, that would be the Houston Rockets. Now, some of that is, Reed Shepherd is only in the last, like, as we're having this conversation, four games or so, really showing some great play, and that he can be a rotation guy for a high-end playoff team. But it's more so that they're just putting these big guys out there and just beating you to death. Like their offensive rebound rate is the highest in the NBA. They're so fun to watch because all they really are doing is attacking and beating people up. And with Kevin Durant roaming the perimeter as this like incredible luxury late in the fourth quarter, while the other times it's people like Steven Adams, and they bring in Clint Capella. It's these, and Amen Thompson is as advertised. It's just these, Eason is just destroying people. I mean, it's just like these waves of big dudes. And it's I love that because it's very counterintuitive to today's, 3-point happy pace and space, get 53s up. They're taking it. I love that they're taking it in a counterintuitive direction of we're going to beat the crap out of you. And through that, we're going to have the best offense in the NBA. I just love that. And then, of course, the Knicks in the East. I mean, my biases are clear, but I think that, the way Mike Brown has them playing is such a improvement, not just aesthetically, but Mikal Bridges is having a great year. He could be a most improved player candidate. It's I like what we're and he was my prediction for most improved player, let me just say. But I really like what we're seeing there. So I think Karl-Anthony Towns still isn't quite sure what he's doing, but that's sometimes how he is on a weekday. So hopefully he'll figure it out. So that's the one, that's the thing I'm putting forward that I'm feeling good about.
Yeah, I mean, both of those teams are looking good. You mentioned the Rockets, and the player you didn't mention was, in my opinion, their team MVP. I'd say Şengün has been the best kind of their engine or motor or whatever phrase people use for
He's
something.
even been playing some point too.
And I think what your description of how Durant fits in is perfect, and I think that Udoka is kind of using him perfectly in that regard. Because if Şengün is unburdened as a number one scoring option, then where your team can go increases exponentially, and it looks as though Ime knows how to coach his team and knows how he wants the players to relate to one another on the floor. So that's looking very good. I have never understood your feelings about Towns' goofiness. That's
Oh,
something.
not goo. Oh, I wasn't going goofy. More, he's averaging 6 points less a game this year than he did last year. I mean, he's spoken openly about not really knowing his role on the in the Brown offense, and I just feel like, come on, dude, you're the most talented guy on the floor. Figure it out.
I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. At this point, I don't know. I guess that if you're having another really good year and you're 10 years into the career and your team is winning, and you still feel a little bit unsure, maybe don't go public with it. I don't have to know that. Figure it out in practice every day.
Just figure it out,
Go to the
dude.
coach's office. But like,
Is funny.
why does that have to be a thing? Karl-Anthony
Right.
Towns has put up 25 points plus a year in a season, and at best that team has ended with a first round playoff loss.
Yeah.
So if you are putting up fewer shots and points a game and your team is winning and is a championship contender, and that team wouldn't be a championship contender if you weren't doing what you were doing, then what's the fucking problem?
Exactly. Keep it to yourself, bodega cat. Said it. All right. Well, Shiraz, I'll throw it to you to go on either front. Did you say anything else before the season that you want to point out that you feel good about, or do you want to touch on something where maybe you feel less than good?
No, we can jump right into the sad stuff. Two predictions of mine look as though my feelings about them were incorrect. One is a refrain that I feel that I've made on this show a few times over the past few seasons, and that's the state of the Sacramento Kings.
That was on my list for
I
you.
have been a believer in the Kings. I was a believer in the Mike Brown Kings, and then even when they moved on from him, I like their core. I like veteran teams. And this is a veteran team, so I always have either a belief or a hope that a team built around veterans will figure out how to best maximize those parts. And the complaints about who DeMar DeRozan and Zach LaVine are, how they go about getting their points, I thought having Sabonis and Schroeder and what looks like a really rejuvenated Westbrook looks better than he has in 5 years, in my opinion.
Love it.
Or at least, or when he was in DC.
There it is.
And I thought that their passing abilities and inclinations would actually work well with those primary scores and would put them in positions where they didn't just have to hold it. They could get up their points in a more fluid offense. And the offense has not looked particularly good, but really where I don't necessarily have faith in this team turning it around is on the defensive end. The Kings have kind of the dual handicaps of being a short team, having Sabonis in the middle, and while he is as good a rebounder as there is in the league, he is a short five who does not block shots
Right.
or prevent teams from feeling confident in taking the ball to the rim.
Yep, not a rim protector.
And they don't compensate for that by having good perimeter defenders. And yes, their single good perimeter defender, Keegan Murray, hasn't played yet. And I think that whenever he comes back, which I think is sooner rather than later, that should definitely improve things. But I think that this could be fatal. And I say unfortunately because I like all these players and I want them to be key players in winning situations. But I don't know or think that the Kings can be a passable enough defensive team to win games by outscoring opponents every night. So my high hopes for the Kings, which weren't even that high. I had them as a play-in team, which they can still do.
Conceivably.
But Sacramento keeping this team together and putting a scare into some higher seeded teams in April, I ain't seeing it.
No. I want to give you props, though, for two things you didn't say. Not a lot of faith in the 76ers going into the season. They're very strong. Good on you on that. And then the second is that, I mean, I think it would be just absolutely derelict and negligent to not say, of course, Oklahoma City is the odds-on favorite to come out of the West. But when you and I were talking about, like, what team could come out of the West, and I, of course, land on Houston. When you said Lakers, I thought that that was off the beam, and that's looking smart too. I know they just lost Oklahoma City by 30, but I just said let's not talk about Oklahoma City generally. As I've been calling him as a nod to Ned Flanders, stupid sexy Luka has been doing just amazing MVP level work. So excellent to you, sir, on those two
Thank you.
fronts.
I feel great. No, I feel great about the Lakers. I think they're going to the championship. I think Luka's going to win MVP. Now I'm hoping that, I mean, I feel as though this team right now could win it.
Uh-oh, I know where you're
So
going.
it's no, I'm hoping that I'm hoping it can be seamless.
When LeBron comes back.
Austin Reeves legitimately becoming a number two and one of the better number twos really changes things. It's almost now an embarrassment of riches because of the absent player that we're dealing with, who, regardless of who else is there, and this goes for every single player in the league, if LeBron is on your team, that is still the story. So that is, I'm crossing my fingers that when James comes back, it will be in a way that already enhances this roster, which I actually think is the best in the NBA. I think this is the best roster in the league built around the second best player in the league. The non-Lakers thing that I will say is another thing that I'm feeling like I might have gotten wrong. Which is, I was not high on the Timberwolves. I actually
That
felt
still
like
stands.
they were going to take a step back. And while I'm not ready to make any lofty predictions about where I think they might land, because I honestly have no idea, I had talked about Hawkes as an early most improved player candidate. My most improved player thus far is Jaden McDaniels. McDaniels has been, for the past few seasons, on the short list of best perimeter defenders in the league. He has played that role on a team that has won a lot of games over the past few years, and at 6'10, 6'11, his length gives him a huge bonus relative to some of those other perimeter stoppers. McDaniels is scoring over 20 points a game, and from what I've seen of the Wolves, he's doing it by hitting open threes, hitting contested threes off the dribble, and taking the ball to the basket and using his height advantage over who's ever guarding him to pull up and hit a short jumper. So if McDaniels can become an every night number three scorer behind two very good scorers, in addition to being the perimeter stopper that guards anywhere from point guard to power forward, and the reason he never has to guard center is that Rudy Gobert is on the team. If this is who McDaniels is, and not just kind of early season overachievement, then Minnesota can be a lot better than I thought they were going to be, and they've already been to the last two Western Conference Finals. So that bodes really well for where that team could land.
Awesome. Yeah, the one thing that I'm going to throw down with of what I feel good about, and I'll just do what I feel good about in my yikes, is I had a very, very high estimation of the San Antonio Spurs. I think I had them as the number three team in the West, which was way beyond what people were talking about. No, I think I had them at four. But either way, a top four team in the West for the Spurs. When most people were debating play in or not play in, and I was like, nah, that ain't the way it's gonna be. And but the thing that I was excited about was Dylan Harper. But the thing that I did not see is the person who I think is really gonna be the most improved player, and that's Stephon Castle. I mean, good God, some of what he is doing is unbelievable. First, how about this statistic for you? First 20-year-old since Magic Johnson with four consecutive games with over 10 assists. I mean, I never even thought of Castle as a passer in that way coming out of UConn, just as this incredible talent. And clearly he's in developing those talents to do things he wasn't even doing as a rookie. His 3-point shot is still terrible. So what? I mean, the way he sets people up is amazing. And of course, the way he sets up Victor, who is a legit, he's not going to win it, but he's a legit MVP candidate right now, Victor Wembanyama. And I think that's also a year ahead of where people thought he would be. And the one thing I was nervous about was, okay, Fox coming back from injury, how's that going to look? De'Aaron Fox has been great. He's been great. And he actually takes away one of the things that people were starting to use against Victor, which is like one or two teams slowed him down by guarding him with like a power forward and then just leaving the center to roam a little bit or jump on him. And you can't really do that with Fox out there slicing to the hoop in the same way. It just creates too many matchup problems because then he can also lob it up to Victor with a power forward on him, which Castle's been doing as well, which is why he has those crazy assist numbers. So I feel great about that Spurs pick. I don't think it's going to happen, but I feel, and it wasn't that crazy a pick, but picking Giannis for MVP. I like the way the Bucks are. And just a little stat for you, Shiraz. I know you're not as big stat guy, but how about this? Giannis is averaging 28 points in the paint per game, which is more than many teams are getting in the paint during a game. I mean, it's wild stuff, especially when you factor in the number of free throws he's getting, because he's just not shooting threes anymore. He's like, screw it. I'm bigger, stronger, and faster. I'm going to go inside and dunk on your head. And I mean, the Bucks, when they're on, I'm watching, because it's just fascinating to watch somebody play that way in today's NBA. Well, one last thing, Shiraz, before we go. Do you have anything to add before I have one last little comment for you to comment on, and then I think we might have to call it a day. Anything I'm missing?
No, go ahead.
All right.
Jump to the next thing.
We've been talking a lot about most improved player. And the nature of the award is that you win it once in your career. No one wins most improved player twice because it's not a comeback player. It's not coming back from injury. It's because you've taken a big leap as a player. And I think this year we actually have a shot at a two-time most improved player. And it's your guy, Tyrese Maxey. And how cool would it be for Tyrese Maxey to be a two-time most improved player? Basically, hey, dude, you have taken two leaps in your career that are impressive enough for you to win this award twice. Now, I don't think he's going to win it. I think we named some of the leading candidates from McDaniel to Castle and the like. But one of the reasons why I love the idea of Tyrese Maxey winning it is something that I know you're aware of, but I'm going to repeat this history. The only reason why there is a most improved player is because it used to be called the comeback player of the award, but that award was basically vanquished by Michael Ray Richardson because he kept winning it after going back in for rehab for cocaine, and then coming out and winning comeback player of the year, and then rehab, and then comeback player of the year. So the NBA got, freaked out about that and said, let's call it most improved. So, which is a whole different kind of mindset of understanding the award. I am saying all that, of course, because we lost Michael Ray Richardson this last week. One of the great players who I ever saw growing up. He was just 70 years old, way too young. This is just me doffing my hat to the best big point guard, not named Magic Johnson, I ever saw growing up.
I will doff my hat as well to Michael Ray Richardson, who I really enjoyed watching as a New Jersey Net, before he prematurely left the league in the mid-80s. Pardon me. But regarding Maxey, while the notion, yes, of, he's made that extra leap to possibly be considered most improved again, I think at this point, Maxey is an MVP candidate.
Yeah.
Maxey's, I mean, because Maxey's playing like an MVP. And the reason that the Sixers have looked good in the early going with George not playing yet and Embiid certainly not looking like he's ever going to be that MVP winner again. But now they have another MVP candidate, and he's playing like it. Tyrese Maxey is an unbelievable scorer. He is an unbelievable scorer. He's like one of the very quickest guys in the league, and now he's got a pretty reliable put up a pull up 29 footer. So, I mean, so Maxey is an almost impossible guy to guard. We have talked about how great Edgecombe has looked in the early going. He's fallen a little down to earth, but I mean, he's a 19-year-old rookie guard. Quentin Grimes looks great. Your man Oubre is a big part of why the Sixers have started
I never
strong.
sold my stock in the career of Kelly Oubre. Never.
And if this version of Maxey can team with functioning starters, Embiid and George, being able to stay on the floor enough to be able to really carve out what their roles are around the new alpha. Then I still believe that Philly has as much of a upside as any team in the conference.
And not a lot of people were saying that before the season. A lot of people are saying it now. I don't only doff my hat to the late, great Michael Ray, but to you, sir, Arya Shirazi, for bringing us counterintuitive takes that more often than not go swish. Well,
Thank you.
oh, you're welcome. Well, that's all for this week's show. Thank you so much to Paul Knepper for his book on Moses Malone. I'm so excited to read it, I can't even tell you. Thank you so much to Arya Shirazi for joining us. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty and support The Nation magazine. We are out of here. Peace.